Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of Olathun Civilization Site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Hey, Madeline. With guest co-hosts...
Cybershark.
Heraclitus.
Do-do-do-do.
What is that?
That was Imran's attempt at sync.
Oh, warn me next time.
Please do it again. Let me record it. It's beautiful.
Welcome to episode 41 of Polycast, an official podcast of Poland Civilization Site. I am Imran Siddiqui, Imran Siddiqui on the forums. Hi. I am joined by Daniel Quick, Dan Q on the forums.
Hi there. And yes, Imran did that in one take.
I'll kill you later. Makalua?
Hello. One take, not.
Joined by Robert, Cybershy on the forums.
Yeah, that's true. My wife laughed big time at my name yesterday.
What, your real name or Cybershy?
I hope it was Cybershy.
And also we are joined by Samo, known as Heraclitus on the forums.
Hi, all.
Civ 4 trait, miss the most when you do not have it. So this is not your favorite trait, but the one that you miss the most, again, when you don't have it.
I don't think I'm experienced enough to answer this question.
I have to pick spiritual just because it has a lolcat reference in the poem. Do not want.
Do not want.
I'm going to have to go with creative. Where's my immediate fat crosses?
No, it's philosophical. You have to wait for your great prophet, your great scientist for ages. I always miss them when I don't have it.
I guess I haven't played with enough philosophical leaders to notice the difference. I'm so used to it taking a while.
I like the next topic, things you just can't resist. I'm like, we're just keeping this to the game, right?
This is a family-friendly show.
Since when?
I can't resist building great prophets for all my holy cities. And sometimes I even have four holy cities and I have to build a great prophet for all of them. And I end up with a lot of holy cities back in the medieval.
Way back there.
Whoa.
In the medieval period. I end up in being in the medieval period forever, and well, that sounds good because that's where all the holy cities come from anyway.
There was someone here who said that they just had to get to certain technologies first so they could get the great whatever. Whoever said that, I'm with you. It's like every turn. All right, let's go back and mouse over the technology to see if someone's actually taking it. No, they haven't. One turn away. Damn.
In the news, we discussed Take-Two Interactive asking its shareholders not to sell to the evil empire that is Electronic Arts, the official Civ Revolution website launched, and patterns of video game use and whether or not it makes us into vicious monsters. Brains.
We could do some of those.
Brains.
The research lab, we talked about extending the medieval period.
In the Senate, we talked about defending against amphibious attacks in Civ 4 and the specialist's use. When does it specialize your cities? After full population or sooner?
Yeah, it's a good thing you did Senate because, you know, I would have been like, which ones did we talk about again?
He's like, dude, I took a nap during that part.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Take-Two Interactive is fighting back. They're asking their shareholders not to sell to the evilness, which is Electronic Arts, who is trying to hostily take over Take-Two.
And notice that one of their financial advisors is Bear Stearns.
Oops. It seems that EA offered $26 a share, which is $2 billion, which is 64% premium for the shareholders over Take-Two's share price. And apparently, they're not actually selling at this point. Or Take-Two is telling them, don't sell.
I agree. $2 billion, that's about 100 euro.
No, like, no, that's not, that's not like 5 euro. Haven't you been watching the exchange rate lately?
Is it 5 already?
It's underpriced.
Yes.
I think it is, especially considering Grand Theft Auto 4 coming out.
Mm.
And I am slightly annoyed by everyone, I do mean everyone, leaving only comments about GTA. If someone didn't know what this company was about, they would probably think, those are the guys that made GTA. Nothing about Civ, nothing about the sports stuff.
Wait, they make Civ?
Yeah, it's this game, and you play, like, the civilization and stuff, Imran. Right. Have you heard of it?
What? Oh. Interesting thing. I guess they're being informed, as Max said, by Bear Stearns and also Lehman Brothers, that the offer price was not enough. Especially, like I said, Grand Theft Auto 4 is about to come out, and that'll probably drive up the share price. But other people, such as, it seems from the article, Michael Pachter from Wedbush Morgan, said that Take-Two Decision is a mistake because they think the board has no chance of finding a better offer. On the other hand, I mean, it could be that maybe instead of extracting a higher offer from EA, are like, no, we don't want to destroy our company.
Yeah, it's telling that two major investors had already sold off some percent, and another investor actually filed a lawsuit against the company for not taking the offer.
Yeah.
It's like, what, you filed a lawsuit against them for not being stupid? I mean, it's like three or four greedy people that want them to sell now, and most of the rest of the stockholders are smart enough to go, this is bad.
Well, the shareholders want the money, I mean.
Yeah.
In essence, they're like, oh, you should sell now so I can make 64% more on my share and go buy something else.
If we're going to keep going under after I sell my shares, I just want my money.
If the cynical explanation is true, then probably Take-Two is holding out for more money.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but it's perfectly probable in all essence is most likely true.
Oh, I'm sure it is, too.
They're business people. They don't care about games. I mean, who does?
Well, and also, since they're a public company, you know, they have to be attributed to what's best for their shareholders. Getting a big premium on the price probably would be better for their shareholders. So, in essence, that's what this lawsuit's about, too, that they're not acting in the best interest of the shareholders, they're acting in the best interest of the officers.
Yeah, but that shareholder is either stupid or bribed, because they can get more money out of EA.
Yeah, that was EA's first offer.
If that's their goal.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It really is, if I'm on the business news pod, not on the game pod, it's interesting.
Well, I mean, the guy from Wedbush Morgan basically said Take-Two could have gotten a higher offer if they didn't refuse and close negotiations.
With Take-Two in response saying, telling shareholders to not to take EA up on their offer, they released a statement listing 10 reasons why they didn't want the deal to go ahead, most of which Take-Two had already expressed. In addition to the inadequate price that, quote-unquote, substantially undervalues the company, I like this reason, that the EA offer is opportunistic. Well,
what do you expect of EA?
And what do you expect of a business?
Well, exactly. No. That's what they're supposed to do.
So I found this interesting, that the company took further action to make a hostile takeover more difficult, following the initial offer that Take-Two rejected before the hostile takeover attempt, established a poison pill clause that would allow for the creation of new shares in the company if any individual shareholder acquires 20% or more of the company in the next 120 days, and that pill would also be triggered if an investor currently over that threshold acquired an extra 2% of the company.
I like that. That's a good idea.
Very prudent.
Indeed.
The management of Take-Two, do they have stocks themselves? That's an interesting question.
I assume that a lot of them probably do.
Because if they do, then it's in their own interest to have a price as high as possible.
Yeah.
But if they don't have stocks, maybe really after the success of the company itself.
They may also be after trying to keep their own jobs.
Because management, usually the first place where heads start rolling after an acquisition.
I had thought that the $26 per share offer had been from the outset, but I guess the initial offer Electronic Arts made to Take-Two's board was $25 per share. So then they increased it a buck per share.
Mm.
And then apparently, after they made the offer known to the public, Take-Two stocks went up by 54%, closing over the $26 price.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And EA's own stock prices went down by 5%, the largest loss in over a year.
So the rest of the market is like, yeah, bad idea.
Actually, while we're here, I'm at Yahoo Finance now. On the NASDAQ right now, it is at $25.33. So the share offer price would be less than a dollar more than they're currently worth.
What's a dollar?
Most of the time, it's a 1 cent difference.
Yeah.
Ooh, 1 cent difference.
It shows like a lot of people don't have faith that the takeover will actually happen.
Yeah, of course, if they're trying to do a hostile takeover, Electronic Arts is, they're going to have to seriously jack up this price. Because now, after this story came out, which was posted March 26th, the share price right now is, you know, not far from that $26 per share. So seems that maybe Take-Two is asking for more money or realizing that EA can't offer much money as, I don't know.
I think it's pretty far from the price. I mean, I'm not sure how the stocks are in New York, but over here in Holland, you see stock prices raised to 1 cent, euro cent. So that's about $15 cent. And the price that the wholesale takeover company is offering.
Mm.
So I think if there's almost a dollar difference, that that means that there are a lot of people that don't want to be sure about it's going to happen eventually. You even see sometimes the price goes to $27.
Yep.
In this example. So people are speculating that there will be other parties involved and they may try to get a bit of it.
If you look at the history of the price, February 22nd to February 25th jumps by a lot. It jumps by almost 10 points up there. I assume that's what Dan was talking about, where the stock price of Take-Two jumped. Because before that, it was trading around 16, 15, 17, around there. And all of a sudden, it jumps up and it's been trading at 25, 26 ever since.
Right, so whereas $26 a share a couple of months ago was a pretty big deal, now it's pennies.
Yep, exactly.
More or less.
Something like, say, the opening price on March 6th would be above $26 a share. So in the end, I mean, it seems that, yeah, EA basically has to go back to the drawing board or just give up.
I don't think they'll give up. I doubt it. It's not in their character.
No.
Not consistently pure evil.
No, right now they're rubbing their hands together with glee and going, a challenge.
No. Well, yeah, now they got to jack it up to, I don't know what they're going to have to offer. They're going to probably have to offer 35 or 40 if they want to engage in a hostile takeover. The comments, though, are kind of funny. Well, the comments in that first article, though, now, if you look back about from Michael Pachter or whatever, says, we think the board has virtually no chance of finding a better offer.
This guy has no idea. A console player, probably.
Well, it seems that EA is going to try to probably increase their bid and go to the shareholders themselves. If the company doesn't want to sell, they'll say, hey, your share price is only 25. We're going to offer you $10 more a share, see how many people actually go for it.
It's my experience that as soon people are starting to bid on companies, that the companies will be sold in the end anyway.
It usually happens.
Maybe to another company, but when you're the prey, then all the hunters will gather around you and you're toast.
They smell blood.
The interesting question is, who's next after EA took over Take-Two? Then what will happen next year? Microsoft?
Oh, no, they're going to go after Activision Blizzard, assuming that merger goes through between Activision and Vivendi. So then they can be known as Electronic Arts Activision.
Electronic World of Warcraft? What?
Well, Grand Theft Auto 4 came out. What's next?
Five.
Grand Theft Auto 5.
Grand Theft Civilization 5.
Ooh. Grand Theft City Civilization 5.
Beyond the car.
Beyond the car.
What a shiny website.
Yes, CivRev.
Loud and shiny Rev website.
Yeah, I know. I clicked it. I just clicked it now the first time. I'm like, oh my, that's soundy.
Yeah.
Not too historically correct, though.
Something about Cleopatra, because she's not hot enough, right?
I wasn't. Well, in some ways, I know there's the black Cleopatra thing. It isn't logical. She was Greek. It makes no sense to make her look like a sub-Saharan African. Really doesn't. But so doesn't the... Oh, my God, they made Alexander blonde. No. They have no respect for history. And I'm just looking at the map here. Since when is Arabia in the Sudan? If you go to the thumb view and switch to the map view and you have this pretty map of the world, you have all the civs, you have, I think it's Elizabeth in England, and you have here Napoleon in France, and you have Cleopatra in Egypt, and there's Saladin, south of Egypt. It makes no sense. He was a Kurd, damn it. If you don't put him in Arabia, put him in Iraq.
And Shaka Zulu's on that. Yeah, they just kind of threw him in South Africa. They're like, oh, well.
Well, nobody really cares about Shaka.
That's true.
It's some African dude.
Mongolia is not there.
No, it isn't. It isn't. It really isn't there. But once again, it's some Central Asian dude.
I'm blaming this on Take-Two.
I'm blaming this on EA. They must be using their evil, corrupted influence.
Oh.
Already.
Wasn't Mongolia everywhere during the time of Khan?
Well, okay. There you go.
Yeah, you can throw them anywhere. Yeah, that's true.
And shouldn't Montezuma, the Aztec nation, be more towards, I don't know, where the Aztecs were rather than the Yucatan?
Yeah, like Mexico City.
Yeah, rather than where the Mayans were.
There's no civilization in South America.
Yeah, I noticed that too. No Incas.
They had to make some tough choices. They had to have a token Native American civ, and you can't skip America.
And I think it's pretty interesting to see that Catherine is the Russian leader.
Well, yeah, but she's kind of weird.
I don't know what she's supposed to be wearing there.
Well, yeah, well, what is that? Okay, there's a nice bus, but that's not worth it.
To you, maybe, to all the console gamer guys. Huh, boobs. That's what they're going to be thinking.
Oh, yeah.
It's all part of the AI strategy to win.
Exactly.
Ooh.
This is a nice website, Nan. I like the map view and all, but what the hell?
Well, the website's nice. Yeah.
It stopped loading videos at my site. Oh, there it is.
It's slow sometimes.
It's really slow.
Yeah.
When I'm not chatting, it works pretty well. I suppose it has a bigger load. What, 6 people are on it now?
Okay, well, I'll stop browsing the site now so you guys can see you. Maybe we can switch later on in the show.
I'm looking at the screenshots here. These advisors seem pretty interactive. That may be a very good thing. I mean, everyone loved the Civ 2 advisors. They were the High Council.
Oh, yes. When I playtested the game last fall, the advisors were definitely one of the highlights, especially the science advisor at the time.
Do they have Elvis back?
No.
Elvis is dead.
No.
He's left the building, Imran.
He's still dead.
I won't believe it.
It's nice that it links to Apolliton from the main site.
Ooh, that is good.
There's also on the website, if you have a look under the community tab, there is a podcast.
Well, wait, not all at the same time. I did a survey.
You want to introduce the topic?
Well, there was a survey.
About video games.
I can't remember anything but the survey. Maybe someone else could do it.
So it was compared to something we had a few podcasts ago where there was a survey that was about 10 or 12 people and wasn't that professional, apparently. We actually have a real video games research survey with a real, actual professor-type person.
Professor-type person.
There was an amazing option to one of the questions. It said, did you play video games and lose weight? And I was really like, yes, that's what I want.
How is that possible?
Lose
yes,
weight?
Please.
Sure.
How is that possible?
Play Dance Dance Revolution.
I suppose if they stop eating at all, and just...
Yeah, or just eat, like, you know, chips and soda or something like that.
No, that makes you fat. Chips and soda in vast quantities.
Yeah, but you can't die. I mean, you know, then you can't take the survey.
This survey is biased towards those still living players. Not fair.
I guess, yeah, there's also an interesting interview of Dr. Porter on Atomic, asking about his research and findings in video game violence and addiction. Basically, I think his basic goal is looking at these idiots like Jack Thompson who are saying, oh, these shootings are caused by violent video game use, and actually trying to find facts, which is something Jack Thompson's not used to, to see how accurate those sort of claims are. I don't think he believes that they're very...
grounded in fact.
Yeah.
In the survey, there were some questions. It was, when you're not gaming, what are you doing? And, well, there was the obvious option, nothing. But it was going out, watching movies. That it was clearly aimed at 12 to 14 years old kids.
Yeah, it was. But you have to realize that fits the stereotype. And these are the kinds of claims he wants to either confirm or expose as utter ludicrousy. The utter ludicrousy they are.
No, because you were not allowed to take part of the survey below 14.
Oh, you weren't?
No. You weren't, and you're not.
Oh, that's silly. You have to ask parental permission to participate in the survey. If
below 18.
Oh, I thought they could have 12-year-old kids in the survey. They didn't. That's poorly conceived.
Well, you're also assuming that people are being honest. They probably were.
Well, yeah. How many 12-year-olds do you know who like to take surveys? Surveys that don't give you a nice picture and you are the power gamer.
Well, I think what he was trying to do is, in the interview, he says, you know, basically there's TV and film violence studies that have shown, you know, groups of children that are 15 to 17 years old. I think he wants to somewhat try to mirror that to show whether or not video games actually do worse or are the same as TV or film violence.
Well, I think common sense would say they are comparable.
Yeah, I think so. I have a problem with all these kinds of tests because, indeed, I think common sense would tell us a lot.
Well, not always, to say in defense of psychology. It is a very...
No.
The human mind is a mysterious thing. Listen to Freud. Who would ever thought of that of my mother?
No, but one of the questions, it's that after playing games for many hours, do you blame yourself for things?
Those are interesting.
And I'm like, no, I'm perfect. I never blame myself for anything. I hope that everybody will blame himself for anything someday.
Of all the surveys I've seen, not that it's been that many, but any survey that's asked trying to gauge video game use and link it to other things, I think this is actually one of the better ones that I've seen, but certainly it's not... Oh, let's draw conclusions based on the survey. Atomic asked, what has to be done before we have conclusive proof on the effects of violent video games? And I like Porter's response, which is, proof is a strong word. That's right. You're not going to have proof, but you may have conclusive evidence, he says, which will need to come from long-term studies similar to those carried out for TV and film. And Atomic says, well, how would those studies be carried out? And he's talking 15 to 20 years, as done for TV and film study. Well, video games aren't exactly the same as TV and film, so I don't know if you need 15 to 20 years.
Well, in a certain way, they are. I mean, they do occupy a similar amount of time, and they do bring in about similar revenue.
That's true.
More or less.
I just argue that for video games, it's more interactive on the part of the viewer. You're not.
Well, true, it is more interactive, but in many ways, it's just the next logical step. I mean, TV brought media into the home, and before TV, radio. This is the following step. It brings you into the experience as a person, as a player.
But there's a huge difference when you're watching a movie and somebody's being killed. You can...
Well, yeah, but I'm trying to say that before TV and radio, there was no one-way feed. And now that we have games, it's a two-way feed. It's the next logical step.
Yes, that's true. But the difference is that when you're watching a movie, you can identify yourself with the victim or with the killer.
Well,
but when you're playing a first-person shooter, you're always the killer.
We need to invite a proper psychologist to this show. He would do wonders.
You do a podcast on Civilization every 2 weeks? Oh, we're going to need some intensive therapy.
Do you feel dizzy after listening to the podcast? Do you feel the urge to kill people?
Yes, what?
Got news? Email news at apollofm.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, or one of the other news editors.
Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Extending the medieval period.
This was briefly touched upon by Alexander I in episode 39, which actually prompted Lancer to start this thread. Even the question is, extend medieval period in the game, as was discussed briefly on Polycast, I find it absolutely fascinating that no one in that thread so far has said, WTF is Polycast.
That is remarkable.
It's interesting, if you look in the subject line of the opening post, it's should we try to influence the designers to extend the medieval period, but then in his post itself, he says, can we influence the game designers of Civ 4? And I think that's a big difference, is can we, as opposed to should we?
An important difference, yeah.
We always should.
That's why he asked both questions.
Two for one.
But really, we're talking about the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. Do we really want to expand them?
Well, not really the Dark Ages. It's not exactly the same thing. First you have the Dark Ages, and then you have all sorts of things, the Crusades, all the way to the Renaissance. I think most people would really like to play in the High Middle Ages, when you have longbowmen, trebuchets, knights, that sort of stuff. I mean, no one likes a dark age.
The Middle Ages, they were all pretty bloody. I think we should be happy that they are over.
Well, yeah, they were pretty bloody, but some parts of the Middle Ages are prettier than others. You have chivalrous knights and that sort of stuff.
But, and going back into what we just talked about, people like bloody. And besides, I'm not going to turn this into a history argument, but the Dark Ages is a term that has been retired by historians.
Exactly. Not in all languages, though.
Middle Ages, if you please.
The medieval period, it's the Maceman, the Longbowman. I always get the feeling it's long enough.
Well, that is true, but...
After that, then you get the musketeers, the rifleman.
But there's a difference.
That's really going...
That's exactly what I meant. The musketman goes out of use too fast. I mean, I'm all happy. Oh, yay, I'm in Renaissance. And then I'm suddenly in the Napoleonic era. I would really like that sort of 15th, 16th, 14th century feel. You don't get that now.
Oh, it's too short. You don't... I never have the time to even finish a musketeer or rifleman, or it's already obsolete.
Exactly, before they're obsolete.
But it's not for the maceman and the longbowman. There are enough of them. There's enough time.
There's definitely certain eras or certain types of units which are obsolete way too quickly. Perhaps, you know, needs to be expanded in that sort. I mean, I guess, you know, Lancer's talking about the medieval period and everything like that. I mean, you want to be able to at least produce, you know, maybe more than a handful before they go obsolete.
Or perhaps to have one or two games where you really do use them. I mean, you don't have to experience each era in each game to properly experience, but you should see them in some games. This currently it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, the one thing I can say is that perhaps in those terms, maybe I agree a little bit with Cybertai, which is perhaps the medieval period is somewhat realized, and perhaps they should expand, say, early Renaissance or something like that.
I think they should put a new tech in the medieval period, which just lasts for 100 turns or something, is like nothing. That's realistic.
Well, technically, a dark age can happen at any moment. For all you know, nukes could be flying and we're destined to die in a few minutes. And we are spending our final minutes on a polycast. What a sad existence.
I gotta go.
The suggestion, I think you were saying there, Sarshai, about, you know, just 100 turns of Dark Ages and nothing happening.
Players wouldn't like that.
I might be all right with that as, say, a random event, but...
Random event?
Why not? Because I know it's not necessarily realistic, but Civ is about history. It's not about recreating history.
Yeah.
So I think that could be set all right as a random event, but I do like the idea and support the idea of extending the medieval period, and I think Snoopy 369 kind of summarizes a lot of points that were put forth about how to do that. One of them is by introducing new technologies, although I don't like that idea. I think we have enough technologies as it is. But the idea of increasing the cost significantly of the technologies you are wanting to be delayed so that, again, as soon as you get musketmen, they don't become obsolete so quickly. So they don't want to add any more turns to the game.
But
I think if we just increase beaker costs for technologies that would be getting us out of the medieval period, that then we would actually be able to use our musket men, for example, and want to use them because they would actually have an advantage. They wouldn't be so quickly put past us in terms of their usefulness.
I disagree. What kind of happens if you increase tech cost is that you'll get civs that will be stuck in the Middle Ages because they're too small to really get the raw beaker power to bust out of it. That will be really game-breaking. So if we have to choose between game balance and realism, I really don't have to say which we would choose and which we should choose.
Oh, there's no question that any increase in tech cost, you would
need
to...
A big civ can get over Renaissance in, let's say, 20 turns, and a tiny civ will need, like, 200 or 150 turns to get out of it. Perhaps penalty for really, really large amounts of beakers, maybe if you're doing lots and lots of research, like being the top civ in research in GDP, maybe you could trigger a random event then, and you could solve the problem that way.
I think that regardless of whatever age you're in, whether we're talking about the medieval period or not, if you are a larger civ, then you are going to be progressing more quickly anyway through the particular ages. But certainly if we do decide that we are going to increase the number of beakers required for particular technologies, then for game balance, that will probably require you to change other things. For example, perhaps how much increase in output your library gives you for your science research or something like that.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's the thing is we're getting at is if you change one thing, make certain that it's one step forward and not two steps back.
I wonder, what if you just remove the Rifleman and the Grenadier, which is a weird unit anyway, and the Cuirassier?
Well, then you get rid of the Napoleonic era. People like the Napoleonic era. Sometimes I get all the way to infantry before I use my Rifleman. That could be a whole nother problem.
I'm never able to use them. They are always infantry, but those units are there, and then obsolete, and I try to invade my enemy, and all those infantries are there, and they're shooting down my tiny little Rifleman.
It's actually kind of interesting we mentioned both Riflemen and Grenadiers, because the last episode we had a topic about Grenadiers versus Riflemen, and Grenadiers can do. I think they suck, so that's fine with me. Okay.
They used to be a pretty good unit in Civ 4. BDS really nerfed them.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Defense against amphibious attacks in Civ 4. The priest wants to know about defending against amphibious attacks.
I remember back in Civilization 2, then I settled on an island, and then I built a lot of cities, and then I just did it for fun. And then I built fortresses alongside the entire coast, and I filled them up with a lot of units, so it was about impossible to invade them from the sea. Maybe that's a solution.
That, or having a pretty good navy. Standard navy, I mean.
Well, also the thing is, he's on, if I'm reading this correctly, he's on one tile islands.
Oh.
Yeah, so he's worried about the AI coming up with a huge naval stack of doom. And
well, isn't the AI too stupid to do that?
Not beyond the sword.
No?
Well,
not in Beyond the Sword.
The priest, the guy who started the thread, I don't know, is he playing Beyond the Sword? He didn't say exactly.
That's a fair point. He also doesn't know what difficulty level he's playing on.
Oh, that's true as well.
He does note later that aggressive AI was turned on, but yeah, we don't know what level, and we'll just assume it's at least noble level and that he is playing Beyond the Sword. There we go.
Okay.
I solve everything.
It's good, because, you know, if we were to assume that he was playing imperialism, things would be very different in this discussion right now.
Yeah, that would be in the imperialism podcast.
Well, a simple way to defend against a naval invasion is to have lots of privateers and then upgrade them to destroyers. They have the sentry promotion, so you can see the ships as they come in and stop them, presumably.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah, I would say have a combination of destroyers and submarines.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, subs are good, too.
But the problem is that you may be too late. Maybe he comes in, destroys your city, and then it's your turn, and you can destroy his boats.
Well, a few well-promoted infantry units together with a machine gun unit, that should mostly solve his problem.
I think so.
Yes, and Whitlitch also has the solution that in the more modern era that he can have a screen out to see the stacks coming ahead of time, and he can always just nuke them.
Oh, that's a very good idea.
An interesting solution.
Yeah.
I used to do that in Civ 2. You can nuke away the world's navies and no fallout will appear whatsoever. Nice. No one cares about the fish.
You're just going to get some really odd three-eyed fish.
But sushi starts producing unhealthiness.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, nuclear war that, like Whitlitch suggests, no, no. Because if someone points out, well, yeah, you might have the bomb, but then so could all of your rivals. And we would assume that, oh, they would only detonate them in the water, so that wouldn't be an issue, right? Yeah. The priest mentions that they are up to the period for infantry, destroyers, and transports, so you should also be along very well with your air force. And yes, with Beyond the Sword and the limits of the number of units that you can have, air units you can have in your cities, definitely have airports in your cities, and especially bombers.
Yeah, bombers are useful, but it's really the same issue as with a navy. They can come in too fast for you to do anything, and your bombers would be sitting on the runway. Completely useless.
That would only be one part, would actually be to have the bombers one part of the solution. I don't think any of these 1 points on their own is good enough. Make sure that all your coastal cities that you're going to be building your naval units definitely have a dry dock there so you can give it promotions. Because some random person, blitz destroyers, or with blitz you can attack multiple times per turn, but that's assuming you have reached combat 3 And this person is talking about going for a culture victory, so just destroyers in general. I don't think Blitz necessarily, no.
Another thing you could do, you could use your espionage to help you a bit with that, see what the enemy's doing, just have lots of spy specialists in the city, and there you go. I mean, it could work.
By the way, Dan, the Blitz Destroyers was Woden.
Oh, well,
Woden 11.
Yeah, and Moonwolf, with the spies things, talks about use spies to destroy their uranium mines, and mention there of actually having them in the cities.
That's a very good idea. That's very useful. It stops the nukes from coming in.
What I have ended up doing on really maps comparable to this is that I will build submarines, and just so I have the proper line of sight, and so that they're invisible to, you know, most other units, around and out of my cultural borders, so I can see what's coming. I certainly don't expect them to be able to stop anything.
Specialist use.
Yes, after full population or sooner. NFIH, which makes you wonder, what does that acronym really stand for? Let us know. Here's the dilemma I constantly face. At what point should I have my great person cities go all out to make GP full-time? Do I wait until the city has grown to full population size and then switch as much of the population over to specialists? Or do I wait until I've got a building that allows specialists and then run one or two specialists that these allow, but as a consequence, severely cutting back the city's growth and ability to actually build things? Well, there is this thing called the happiness cap, so you don't necessarily want it to just keep on growing and growing and growing.
You basically just need those specialists to get the GP in your GP farm. You could just beeline for drama, get the Globe Theater. You could just get that in the city and put in a national epic, and you could have specialists before full population. I mean, that's the point of having a GP farm, to get lots of great people as early as possible.
It's always a problem, because building specialists or assigning specialists, it basically stops the cities producing anything. When I build a lot of great scientists or specialist scientists, I need a library in there, but I can't build a library when my city is full of specialists. In fact, it's better to start with a scientist as soon as possible, but it basically stops your civilization from growing. It's a dilemma.
Well, yeah, but on the other hand, if you're running representation, it's useful. It's very useful. The stunted growth, it is worth it most of the time if you
yes.
get a certain tax fast enough, because you'll end up growing faster later on in the game.
Absolutely. But early in the game, a specialist has a really high value. Well, later in the game, one specialist has...
If you're early in the game, then you can't really run that many specialists unless you have caste system.
Yes, caste system is the key of a real specialist academy. It's not so difficult with the Oracle or even full research towards Code of Laws. You really can be there really quickly, and then you can go to philosophy.
Yeah, if you use the Oracle, you can get really, really fast.
Another problem I always have is, in fact, I only like one kind of specialist, it's a scientist.
Yeah, me too. I can't bring myself to run priests. They're just worthless.
Oh, no, I never build a priest.
No. Well, that's my problem. When I have a holy city, I really need to build a great prophet to settle it in the holy city. It's a problem of me, because I know that I will do much better if I just skip it, but I have to do it. I can't play without doing it.
Well, I always like one great prophet if I founded a religion for the shrine, and then after that, if I get them, well, fine, but that's really all I would want a great prophet
for. I generally use them for golden ages after the first great prophet, because they're just useless for anything else. Or maybe settle them, but golden ages...
Settle them. Two hammers, that's quite a lot, and five gold, certainly in the early ages.
Yeah, exactly, in the early game.
But the problem is, when you need a great prophet, it's always, when I just assign one prophet specialist, it's taking ages before I get a great prophet. But when I assign some scientists to the city as well, then suddenly only great scientists will show up. It's a law of civilization that you will always get a great person you don't want.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's why some people sort cities. You have the great scientist city, the great prophet city, the great engineer city. They pick and choose their wonders and specialists in such a way that there's a 100% chance. And then they just slow the city. They don't want to produce the great person first. And, yeah, that's it.
Yes, but then you have to build a great prophet city, and it takes
before
you finally get a great prophet.
It does, but...
Well, you should, in the meantime, really have a city only filled by city specialist scientists.
Yep.
And for me, I prefer, as soon as I can, to actually have great engineers. in my city. So I'm as soon as I can build a forge, whatever technology that comes around.
Metal casting.
Thank you, metal casting. I'm always going for that. We've talked in the past episodes about certain types of specialist economies. So, for example, if you're like me and you're not a specialist economy person, then you never touch cast system with a 10-foot pole.
There's a good way for competitive play to have other people give you advice. That's the Apollonian person.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Apollon.net/forums?
Really? Wow. How could I figure that out from Apollon University?
I don't know.
Sometimes I wonder.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at polycast@apolton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show Montcast, or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
Maybe that's one of the problems with civilization. Why can all the old leaders understand each other?
They have translators, dude.
Universal translators, yeah. What are you talking about? Everybody knows that.
I think that's cool.
It's the first tech in the tech tree.
A foreign Sith comes in, you don't understand each other, both you want peace, but, well, you get war because...
Well, no, see, this is why they get so annoyed if you try to contact them a lot, because there's this whole thing you don't see where you have to have translators and have to who sits here and who sits there and, you know, all that diplomacy stuff.
I think they should introduce the universal translator as a new tech. I mean, GalSiv has it. Why couldn't Civ have it?
Because GalSiv is in the future?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you had Atlantis. Atlantis was real. Why not have this?
The lost city of Atlantis is a relic in Civrev. Tie-in. That was very good.
Ooh.
Unbelievable start location.
Oh, yeah, that one was nice. He's got crabs, he's got fur.
Oh!
I thought it was unbelievable bats.
Whoa, really?
I hated the location. Yeah, there's no food at all. Okay, that bit, but not the best.
Yes, as in the next post, Willem said, nice cash cow, but you have a hard time producing enough food to keep all those tiles working. And forget about any specialists.
We're talking about the capital. It's silver. Silver is not so good as gold. It's only silver. And there's not a lot of hammers on it. No, it's not that good.
I guess it's one of those things, if you've had crappy starts for a while, that looks pretty good.
Oh, perhaps so.
Well, it's unbelievable bad. It would be an amazing second city. So, he should go back to the world builder and create a real unbelievable start location.
Actually, I think the starting location, I think you'd be wanting to stay in the medieval period a long time so your furs don't go off.
Oh, that could be true.
Well, thank you very much for listening to Polycast episode 41. And we have Daniel Quick here as our host. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
He's one of the regular co-hosts, Dan Q. There's Imran Siddiq.
Hey. I mean, bae.
Makaluya.
Hello. Or goodbye. Whoops, I forget which end we're on.
Adviazen, goodbye.
We had guest co-host Heraclitus.
Bye all.
And my name is Cybershy.
And you were also a guest co-host?
And I think that's your forum handle.
I'm also a guest co-host, yes.
And you can say bye, too.
And I can say bye, too. Bye-bye. Thanks for letting me be here.
Oh, no problem.
Oh, you're welcome.
Come again.
Okay.
Take my spot.
Save me from my spot. Help me. Let me out.
Hit the shiny red button at the same time.
All right.
Shiny red button. Okay.
4, 3, 2, 1, click.
Can we do it again?
He clicked the red button for the hang up the call, huh?
That's the wrong shiny red button.
Welcome to the 40...
41. Not quite 42.
Welcome to the 41st edition of Podcast, the official and official... Oh, crap. I messed that up the last time I did it, too.
At least all right. Consistent.
That's true. Welcome to the 41st edition of Podcast and official Podcast.
Thank you very much for listening to a Polycom.
No, that would be the
It's a Polycast. Thank you very much for attending a Polycom.
Record date?
March 29th, 2008.
Sound clips copyright Civilization IV and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Copyright 2008 Apollothan Civilization site at apollothan.net.